This is the State of Things from the Full Frame Theater at American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. This panel is held in front of a live audience in conjunction with the nonprofit organization Leadership Triangle. Earlier this year, Governor Pat McCrory signed a bill into law that lifted the ban on fracking or hydraulic fracking, fracturing in North Carolina. Legislators say fracking permits could be issued as early as this coming spring. The process extracts natural gas from deep within the earth. It is a controversial one. Opponents say fracking could cause air and water pollution and adversely affect vulnerable populations. Advocates say fracking could bring economic prosperity and jobs to the state. So, how will fracking operate in North Carolina? The state's Mining and Energy Commission was tasked with developing rules for fracking in the state. Vikram Rao chairs the commission, and he is also the executive director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium and a former chief technology officer at Halliburton. Vic Rao, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here. Also joining me is Hope Taylor. She's executive director of Clean Water for North Carolina. That group is part of a network of organizations that opposes fracking. Welcome, Hope. Good to have you here. Kathleen Gray is director of Environmental Resource Program and a lecturer at the Institute for Environment at UNC Chapel Hill. Her research focuses on public health and community engagement. Welcome, Kathleen. And Ted Fitzhans is an attorney and a professor in agricultural and resource economics at North Carolina State University. He has written on the economic implications of fracking in the state of North Carolina. Ted, welcome. Vikram Rao, let us start with you. You've been in this industry a long time. Give us the basics. What is fracking? What's going on?
First of all, the reservoir rock that the industry goes after is considered unconventional. What makes it unconventional is that it is not very permeable. Permeability is the property that allows fluid to flow through rock. So since not very permeable, in regular reservoirs, you drill the hole and the oil or gas flows into the hole. It won't in this case. So for the longest time, the industry did not pursue this this particular resource. And two technologies came into being that made it possible to produce from this sort of reservoir. One is hydraulic fracturing, which actually has been around for 70 years, but another technology came along called horizontal drilling, which was a significant enabler. So basically, I'll tell you in a second how those two come together. So what industry does is they drill a hole in the ground and then go horizontally along the bedding plane of the rock. And the reason they do that is that most rock is laid down horizontally. So if you want more contact of the fluid with the well bore, then you should go horizontal. So typically these wells will be about 5 to 12,000 feet in vertical height and about 5 to 10,000 feet horizontal. Then you put in a high-pressure waterborne fluid, basically an aqueous fluid with some amount of chemicals, and it cracks the rock open, it produces artificial permeability, then you bring the water back, that's called flowback water, that has potential issues from an environmental standpoint, and then the gas flows. That's how it works.
All right, and what are the challenges to this technology? You say it's been around for 70 years, but we haven't heard much about it, so there must be some challenges and some costs that are associated with this.
Yeah, the main challenge from a producer standpoint was how do you get this to flow continuously? So because it's a relatively new technology, at this time, only about 4 to 5% of the resource in place is being produced in the case of oil. And in the case of gas, only about maybe 10%. And that means you're leaving a lot on the ground. That means there's a resource you're not producing. Some people are actually happy about that. But at any rate, so technology has to be addressed to be able to produce more continuously.
All right, and we know some of this is already going on. Where is it most prevalent in the U.S.?
So in the U.S., it started out primarily in Texas and Oklahoma, and then it moved to Pennsylvania, which is called the Marcellus Formation. There's bits and pieces in Louisiana as well, and the dominant plays right now are going to be in Pennsylvania and New York if they allow it, and then in North Dakota and Wyoming where there's mostly oil, not gas.
There must be sort of geological markers that you look for to know whether it's a good place or not such a good place. How does North Carolina stack up to those places where it's more prevalent? How similar is North Carolina's potential for fracking to those places where it's being done now?
Very poor in comparison. But very little exploration has been done. So with the amount of exploration done, the prospectivity is very low. The very small amount of gas, and it's presumed to be gas, can be expected in North Carolina. So for North Carolina to be economically, this is not going to be welcome news to some people listening to me, to be economically viable, more exploration would have done to prove that there is a more substantial deposit. Where it is right now, it's not terribly interesting.
Hope Taylor, it is interesting to your organization. You do oppose fracking. Tell us what your concerns are.
Well, they started with concerns that we were beginning to hear from Pennsylvania, or Wyoming, other locations about impacts on private wells. Our organization is really focused on rural drinking water issues. And so private wells, and there are 3 million of us in this state who depend on those, were a major concern as soon as we began hearing descriptions of this technology and from communities. The more we talk to impacted communities, though, the more we realize that some of the most acute health impacts were coming from toxic air emissions, both from the extraction operations themselves and from compressor stations, treatment areas, that sort of thing, storage, surface impoundments. And then we began hearing more and more about the community impacts that were occurring, the disruption of families due to either disagreements about leases or about people who didn't want to be leased being put in a position where they were either right next to where operations were going on or in some cases force pooled, and we'll talk more about that later, I'm sure, into having fracking done on or under their property.
Well, what's the impact on well water? How does it affect well water?
Well, the thing that's happened most frequently is the migration of methane into well water. And there's been a lot of publication in the scientific literature about that recently. But there are plenty of other cases where sediment has shown up and some other contaminants, particularly in places like Wyoming where you have shallow formations that are being fracked. You're actually seeing contaminants that are associated either with the fracking or with other oil and gas operations at the site.
Vic Rell, when that happens, when methane gets into well water, how does that happen?
If it happens, it would be because the well bore was improperly constructed. Either the casing was improper or the cementing was done improperly. A properly constructed well bore ought not to leak methane.
And is there any difference? Because I understand that the shale beds in North Carolina are relatively shallow and a little bit closer to the ground, to the water, than it is in some of these other places. Does that matter?
It could matter, but it won't matter for the mechanism that I'm talking about, which is the vertical portion of the well bore leaking due to improper construction. It could matter for direct communication, but that's a longer discussion. Direct communication from the zone of fracturing, most experts would say you need to be at least 2,000 feet away, vertical feet away. And I would expect that even in this state, which is shallower, you're correct. And most water bodies, most freshwater bodies go only a few hundred feet. So you would have to be a bit careful as to how shallow you'd be allowed it to go.
Hope, is that a concern? Are there rules that could be written that might make you feel more comfortable about
that? There are, and that's specifically one comment that we made to the Mining and Energy Commission was that both based on studies in Europe, a study that was Marcellus Safe Drilling study was done by Maryland and other locations, all recommend at least a 2,000-foot separation between the drinking water layer that's accessed for private or public wells and the shale formation. And in many places where there is the most known about gas in North Carolina and Lee County, the formation is much closer than that to the drinking water layer. So we are very concerned that the fractures could reach, as DOE has confirmed, as much as 1,900 feet above the horizontal drill line.
Well, what do you feel? Vic, you are a chair of the commission that has written a draft set of rules. Is that in the rules, and should it be?
It is not currently in the rules, but let me suggest something, that rules are not permanent, in the sense that you write rules with what you know. Every state in the union right now has readjusted the rules, and to my knowledge, any rule set, any adjustment has been towards more strengthening. So I don't expect the rule set to be static. I expect us to keep learning, and I expect us to adjust.
This legislature now has been very anxious to, though, move things along, judging by many of the statements. So do you sense that you will present them with a set of rules that they are likely to strengthen?
No. No, they have an up-down vote. No, they have an up-down vote anyway. No, it won't go that way. What it will do, I have to be careful, because we are still in public comment in the sense that we have not adjudicated on the public comment yet. But one of the directions it could go is that we send signals to the legislature asking us to go in certain directions. And then on the next go-around, which would be next year when the commission continues to operate, that we go in those directions. That would be one way. The other would be for the public to be more vociferous and deal directly with the legislature on what the legislature should ask us to do. But in the end, we can only do what they ask us to do. That's the law.
On the State of Things today, we will pursue this question further. Vic Rao, Executive Director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium and Chair of the Mining and Energy Commission. Hope Taylor, Executive Director of Clean Water for North Carolina. And when we come back, we'll talk with Kathleen Gray, who's Director of the Environmental Resource Program and a lecturer at UNC Chapel Hill, and Ted Fitzhans, who's an attorney and a professor in agricultural and research resource economics at NC State, when our conversation on fracking continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We'll be right back. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Full Frame Theater at the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're talking with a panel of experts about fracking in conjunction with the nonprofit organization Leadership Triangle. Vic Rao is Executive Director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium. He also chairs the Mining and Energy Commission. We've also heard from Hope Taylor, who is the Executive Director of Clean Water for North Carolina. Now we're going to talk with Kathleen Gray, who is the Director of Environmental Resource Program and a lecturer in the Institute for Environment at UNC Chapel Hill. And Ted Fitzhans is an attorney and a professor in agricultural and resource economics at NC State. So before the break, Kathleen, we were talking a little bit about some of the public health concerns, and I know your research focuses on a community response to public health. What are some of your concerns?
Well, I'll speak about what I heard from the community members that I talked to rather than my concerns. And what I heard, I interviewed thought leaders in North Carolina who've educated themselves about fracking, and colleagues did the same in New York and Ohio. So we talked to 48 people in depth and really learned what their concerns were and related to health and also what they thought the research needs were. And we heard about all of the issues that have already been talked about, water and air quality, as Hope mentioned. We also heard about a suite of public health concerns, the way that communities change by having an industry come in, particularly rural areas like we have in North Carolina that could be host to this industry. There are changes in terms of crime, sexually transmitted diseases, just the nature of the public health system, whether it's prepared, whether emergency responders are prepared to deal with some of the problems that can occur at industrial sites. So there's a whole suite of traditional public health issues that have been documented at sites around the country. But I would say also communities told us that they were really concerned about transparency and open access to information, the need for baseline testing of air and water quality, and the need for ongoing monitoring. So a whole suite of issues.
Well, it's interesting because one of the critiques about fracking as it's developed and as an issue in this state is that we just don't know enough about it. So when these communities express their concerns, essentially what's their database? What have they heard and how do they know and come to these understandings and concerns they have about the health issues?
Sure, that's a great question. And that is why we went to the thought leaders, the people who had educated themselves on the issue. They were all people who either live or work in areas that have shale gas resources, and they have gotten their information from all sorts of different sources. Many of them have done an extensive amount of research in the literature. I'll note that in the environmental health sciences literature, there's very little published information. It's really emerging. And so there's a real call from communities for credible science that we can use to make evidence-based decisions. And so the folks we interviewed have been looking at the published literature and seeing what's there. They've been talking to people in other states that have really active fracking and finding out about those communities' experiences.
Talk about transparency in particular. What are the things that people think they need to know about before they would agree to fracking?
Well, I wouldn't say that people would agree to fracking based on knowing about different things, but I would say that one area of transparency that was particularly important in all three states, and we've heard about it across the country, is disclosure of the chemicals being used in fracking fluids. You may be familiar with, in Pennsylvania, Act 13, where there was an effort to gag physicians in terms of what information could be shared about chemicals. So that was a real hot button for transparency issues. And then there's an area, because I was also doing this work to advise the National Institutes of Health on their research agenda and to give them input from impacted communities as they set their research agenda, there was also a real focus from the community members in terms of who's funding this environmental health sciences research, and if the funding is coming from industry, setting up systems so that there are no conflicts of interest in terms of the results of the research.
Vic Rao, I want to ask you where the rules stand now. We should take one step back and just talk about the rule-making process. You mentioned that the public comment period has closed, and there is a draft set of regulations now, proposed regulations. So what's the next step? What happens with those rules next?
So I appointed three hearing officers led by Amy Pickle. The hearing officers are studying all the public comments, every one of them. And they'll be producing a hearing officer's report to the full commission, and we've just announced that that will be on the 6th of November. 6th and 7th will meet, but we'll start on the 6th. And at that point, the full commission adjudicates on which of the hearing officer recommendations they'll follow. The hearing officer report will be quite specific with respect to which rule sets they want to modify, and the ones they don't want to modify will be very specific on why.
You received quite a few comments. Can you give us a sense of what the response was and how it compares to other calls for response?
Yeah, we've received a lot. It's unprecedented, actually. And I try not to keep bugging the people because they are actually doing the work. So I don't have every time I call them, they do less work because they're speaking to me. So I don't have an exact count. I'll be surprised if it's less than 160,000. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it exceeds 200,000.
Wow.
That's
well,
a lot.
Forgive me for interrupting, but that certainly raises the question of how you even digest that kind of comment in the short period of time you've given yourself, even if you don't bug them with hurry up, call, phone calls.
Yeah. We have a tremendous staff. The dinner staff on it, and I'm not sure how I'm going to. I can't compensate them. That's not allowed by law. But I don't know how I'm going to do it. But tremendous. And then my three hearing officers, they have day jobs too, or at least two of them do. And they're attacking it. Well, you go about it by being as intelligent as you can. So you produce a spreadsheet which is very efficient. You start populating the spreadsheet from the beginning, and you try and use technology to be efficient. The other is we do lump together like comments, which are only small differences. They are substantially the same comment, but we're going to respond to court every comment, but it will be the like comments get bunched together. That requires a lot of skill, so only a few of us can do that, but that's the way we do. So we're doing the best we can. We believe we will be successful in adjudicating on every comment that we receive. I know it doesn't sound possible. Sometimes I wonder, the guys are doing it. When I say guys, it includes gals, by the way.
Talk about this transparency is an issue. There are multiple levels of disclosure when it comes to the chemicals. Tell us where the draft rules stand now.
Where they stand, and I can't quote it verbatim, is that you're required to disclose every chemical unless you hold it back, a portion of it back as a trade secret. The trade secret exclusion will not be given just because you ask for it. So there is a panel of the commission. I'm not aware of any other state that does this. That doesn't mean they don't. and I don't really care what the others do. I want to do it as right as possible here. So there's going to be a panel that is going to require certain evidence to be presented, and we're not going to make it very onerous, but it'll be very exact. And I'm not going to go into what it is. So there is going to be a hurdle to be crossed for you to be able to maintain it a trade secret. Nevertheless, even if you maintain it as a trade secret, it is now already law because the legislature, we discussed it with the legislature, and they passed one important piece of legislation, which is that even stuff that's held as a trade secret will be made known to Diener and will be made known, so we will not get in a situation that Kathleen mentioned, that the physician won't know what it is or disclose it. And we have certain categories, fire marshals, physicians, and emergency responders, who will have that information promptly from Diener. That is relatively new. It took us months to get to that point, but we are there, so that information will be made available. And the other point, even if something is kept as a trade secret, its chemical family has to be disclosed. And in most instances, that's good enough to know what to do with it in terms of a physician response.
And when you say that you have to get permission for it to be classified by the state of North Carolina as a trade secret, will you know what it is? You'll have to know particularly
yes.
what it is?
So the panel will know, but the panel will then trash it and return it because panel will not keep possession of it. Diener will.
Kathleen, I wonder, Hope, did you have a response to that?
Well, I just wanted to talk about another aspect of disclosure, which is where the publicly available information will be, and that right now in the draft rules is FRAC Focus, which is a database that has gotten a lot of criticism for being potentially manipulable by industry, not being comprehensive, being reported only as a PDF on a single well at a time. So in terms of really being useful data to the public, there are real questions about FRAC Focus.
Kathleen?
Yeah, I'll just echo that we heard that same kind of feedback in all three states, that communities would like to have a database that's accessible that might be maintained by a government agency or a body that's perceived as impartial, that is a searchable database that is free access.
Is that part of the rule now, Vic?
No, the part of the rule now is FRAC Focus. We believe it's run independently. If there is a credible alternative approach, we want to hear it. Not something, it's not good, or something else can. If there's a credible alternative approach, we'll want to hear it. Right now, FRAC Focus appears to work.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the communities that might be affected by this. Again, as a kind of a public health issue, Kathleen, do we know where these sites are and which communities are most likely affected? Often when environmental concerns come up, we think about vulnerable populations as being perhaps more deeply affected, but that's often when you have a choice of where to put the landfill, where to put the toxic dump. It seems like fracking, you have to go where the gas is. Is that the same? Do we have the same concerns with fracking that we might in other environmental issues?
Well, there are definitely concerns about vulnerable populations. They may look a little different than some other environmental justice issues. Often when we talk about environmental justice, we are looking at socioeconomically disadvantaged communities and often racial or ethnic minority groups. With fracking in other states, what we see as the vulnerable populations tend to be, besides the workers, who are the ones who are most directly exposed to any potential harmful exposures, the rural populations in some of the states where fracking is occurring, and in North Carolina, New York, and Ohio, tend to also be the socioeconomically disadvantaged. So our rural communities may be more vulnerable. And an example of that would be if you were a low-income person in a rural community who wasn't a landowner, you might still, and your neighbors own land and decide to lease their land and fracking begins, you will be impacted by any of the air emissions or any of the other exposures, and you may not have the ability to get up and move. So that's an example of a different kind of vulnerability.
Ted Fitzhounds, are there labor issues connected with this, and whose labor safety laws would apply in a case like fracking?
Well, there are many labor issues. Certainly, there are occupational safety and health issues. And North Carolina has a federally delegated program. So the OSHA program in North Carolina is run by our Department of Labor. And that brings up questions of expertise, because we have no experience in the state with the oil and gas industry. So people will have to be hired, they'll have to be trained, they'll have to develop experience. the people that are in the most danger are oil and gas field workers. One issue that has been seen is silicosis related to handling the sand that's used in the hydraulic fracturing fluid. There are also issues, when you pressurize a well, you're using a great deal of pressure, and if there are any defects in the well casing or the cement job that Vic Rao was talking about, that's when they're going to become apparent, most likely. And those can cause injuries or death. So there are many labor issues. And then the other thing you have to remember is most of the people that are doing the work here are not always direct employees of the production company. There are many independent contractors involved. And so the labor issues become quite complex.
And that raises the enforcement question, too. And again, given the expertise of the lack of it here in North Carolina, Vic, who will enforce this and how will these rules be enforced? Do we have to create a whole administration in order to do the enforcement?
No, the enforcement has been given to DENR to do. So that's clear. And in every state, that is the case. The DENR equivalent is the enforcer.
But what about the expertise? I mean, we talk about the liners that are required for the water that comes back to make sure for testing the water and testing the air. I mean, all of these things require a lot of enforcement and supervision. Do we have the expertise?
Yeah, on air and water we do, because it's nothing that different about this industry over the other ones. So we have a department. DENR. I have nothing to do with it. There's Department of Air Quality and Department of Water Quality, and they are very good at what they do. But there might be additional expertise required for things like well casings and cementing and so forth, and that will have to be acquired.
And what about the labor force itself? Ted, do we have that here? You mentioned a lot of people are going to have to come in from out of the state and then probably go back home again, right?
An oil and gas labor force doesn't currently exist in North Carolina because we have no oil and gas industry. And we have the same issue with advising landowners, because to have a oil and gas bar with attorneys familiar with oil and gas issues, you have to have an industry, and it's a bit of a catch-22.
Well, you had a very popular talk that you gave in terms of the legal expertise required in understanding what it means to lease your land for this use.
Leasing land for oil and gas production is like any long-term commitment of real property, because the production phase, should there actually be something found, can last for 100 years, however long those wells remain productive, and that can remain a very long time. And that commitment of the land to the producing gas is going to restrict the other uses that one can make of the land. So that has to be thought about quite carefully by landowners before they lease, and their incompatibilities, for example, with agriculture. And these problems can be solved, but they need to be addressed before the lease is signed. So if you have a cattle operation, you need provisions so that you have notice if a fence is going to have to be breached for oil and gas operations. So there are many of those sorts of issues.
You say initially when some of the lease people, I think they're called leasemen, who come in and make landmen who come in and try to get these leases, not a lot of this was known, and some landowners had been weren't properly informed before they signed these leases.
We have a system in North Carolina and the United States called freedom to contract. And that means that you are free to sign any legal contract. There's nobody out there to protect you from signing a bad contract. And if you sign a bad contract, courts will hold you to it.
One of the more interesting features of this, and I didn't realize this until very recently, is that if you sign a 2, 3, 4, 5 year lease, for that would mean to me, after 5 years, this expires and we renegotiate. But it doesn't quite work that way. There's several tiers to this lease that you signed.
Most leases have two phases. You have an exploration and development phase, and then once production begins, you have a production phase. And the typical lease that's negotiated in major oil and gas producing states is usually 3 to 5 years. But once production starts, then the lease can continue indefinitely unless there's a clause in the lease that terminates the lease. And there are some leases that do that. And again, this is not defined by statute or by regulation for the most part. Most states provide some fairly minimal requirements for leases, but everything else is up to the parties negotiating the leases.
And there's not a lot of legal expertise in this area in the state of North Carolina right now.
Well, that's correct, because right now you can't make a living as an oil and gas attorney.
Ask Ted. He knows. Luckily, Ted Fitzhans is an attorney and a professor in agricultural and resource economics at NC State University. Kathleen Gray, director of Environmental Resource Program, the Environmental Resource Program, and a lecturer at the Institute for the Environment at UNC Chapel Hill. Hope Taylor, executive director of Clean Water for North Carolina, and Vic Rao, executive director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium and the chair of the Mining and Energy Commission. And our conversation about fracking will continue on the state of things in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the Full Frame Theater at American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about fracking in North Carolina with our panel of experts, Vikram Rao, who is the chair of the Mining and Energy Commission, Hope Taylor, executive director of Clean Water for North Carolina, Kathleen Gray, director of the Environment Resource Program, Ted Fitzhans is an attorney and a professor in agricultural and resource economics at NC State. Vic Rao, of course, one of the arguments in favor of fracking is economic benefit. Tell us about that.
Well, the economic benefits I can tell you about is for the rest of the country, not for North Carolina, because we don't have any, and it's very hard to extrapolate because we don't know how much we're going to have. But in the rest of the country, the benefit has really fallen into a couple of different categories. One is that this nation is now self-sufficient in gas. It was going to be a net importer of gas, and no longer is, and will soon be an exporter. The other is that in the area of oil, and that's not well understood. Shale oil is we're not going to probably have it here, but we've become a big producer of oil, and that may have been partly responsible for the crash in oil prices that we saw in the last 2 weeks. Basically, and then there's been a resurgence of manufacturing due to the cheap gas. So any industry that needs gas is a dominant feature. There's been basically iron and steel and a lot of chemicals. And then finally, due to the fact that there's cheap gas, it has accrued to the benefit of every family. In 2012, one study showed that every family on average had $1,200 more disposable income, and that number is supposed to be $2,000 in 2015. So these are all the reasons why we have a responsibility to do it responsibly, because the public is getting used to it, used to the benefits, and so we have no choice but to do it right.
What's that extra disposable income? Where does that come from?
That comes from a study by a group called IHS, which is partly industry funded. Therefore, you can take it as you will. But
how do we get that? Is that just because
I think it's mostly from natural gas for heating and cooling.
So because it keeps the price generally low and it competes with other forms. We save that money. Well, Hope Taylor, let me ask you this. Is there a way, given the benefit, and there must be some economic benefit somehow from fracking, is there a way then that the rules could be written that would satisfy you in terms of public safety? Can fracking be done safely?
We don't believe we've seen it in any state done in a way that protects water, air, land, communities, and frankly, governance is another big issue we have with fracking. Given all the federal exemptions that the industry has, the potential to bring in a new source of political dollars that we think would be targeted at and have already been targeted at anti-regulatory work, we think it's very unlikely that we'd ever get stronger regulations from bringing this industry in, and I'm concerned it would get weaker. In terms of cost benefit, I mean, and also as an environmental justice group, we need to look at the distribution of benefits. These would go primarily to relatively large landowners, to some contractors. There would be a few jobs, mostly in trucking and maintenance, for the non-technical workers here based in North Carolina, and some political dollars, as I was saying. Given that we are one of the highest population density areas, the areas that have shale formations in North Carolina, of anywhere where it's been considered, that we have very shallow shales, and that we haven't seen places that have a lot more advantages than we have. You know, we have a small resource. Why would we do this here when, in fact, we face all these additional disadvantages, and we don't believe any other state has administered it in a way that has protected their population?
But is that... So other states haven't, but again, the question is there a way? Do you think there is a way, even though we haven't seen any evidence of it yet?
As a scientist, I never rule out possibilities. There's always probabilities. I just consider the probability incredibly small.
Kathleen?
I'm also part of a national working group with researchers from over 20 universities who are environmental health sciences researchers, and some are people like me who focus on community engagement. And we produced a suite of recommendations about the science that is needed before we could feel that there was credible science on which to base health protective decisions, and there were 19 recommendations. A chunk of them were actually focused on how to engage and involve communities in the research so that the impacted communities could help set the research agenda, but 12 of the 19 recommendations focused on different environmental health science questions that need to be answered before we can say that it can be done safely. So there are so many questions. We don't have enough information today to answer that question.
Well, move away from the science for just a moment, but talk about, again, the sort of public reaction to this. Ted, when you gave that first talk to people interested in how to, you know, what they needed to know before they could lease, there was a big change that came over that group once you began to explain, as particularly the various prices that were being paid for these leases. So tell us about that change, because I think it gets back to the question of public buy-in and how long it might take to win that. But tell us about that.
It was very sobering for landowners to realize how much they need to know and how much research they need to put in to negotiate a lease. They're dealing without any experience with people who are quite experienced in negotiating these leases. So that's one issue. The other issue is the rates that were paid for the bonus payment for the leases that were signed were quite low in the $5 an acre range, whereas in the Marcellus Shale, at least before the prices dropped, we were talking about bonus payments in the range of $5,000 an acre. In less productive areas like the Delta in Arkansas, where for the most part that land didn't yield productive wells, it was still about $400 an acre. So what you're going to get paid depends on what the company leasing the property believes is the potential and how speculative it is. And the fact that companies were only willing to pay in the neighborhood of $5 an acre here means that this is a very speculative play.
And I got the feeling that people came in very excited about the possibilities for them and sort of left that meeting upset and angry at the industry and kind of reluctant to participate.
Well, you know, that's what we lawyers are accused of doing, is destroying people's expectations.
That's your job. Well, Vic, all of this leads to the question, and one of the criticisms is that this is going way too fast, that the science isn't quite there, the public isn't on board. As the public learns more, there's more and more resistance. You've gotten, as you said, unprecedented comment. Should we take our time? Should we slow down a little bit?
You're going to have to differentiate my opinion with that of the commission chair. And so right now I'll stick with the commission chair opinion, which is that we do what the legislature asks us to do. It's up to you guys to persuade the legislature to change their minds. That's point one. Well, that's the way it works. My opinion doesn't really count very much. My personal opinion doesn't really count very much. The other thing I'd very quickly like to speak to the leasing option business is this. People are very ill-informed. That's a bad situation. People like organizations like RAFI do what they can, but we are still not in a good situation with respect to informing the populace on taking care of themselves in this regard. So I want to make that clear. The other thing I want to say is that on the public health issue, we have done woeful work. There's good work being done on water, less good on air emissions, and certainly less good on then connectivity to public health. We need more work. We, meaning not this state, this nation, needs more work done, more excellent scientific work done, as has been done with water. And I will tell you this on the water thing. Hope mentioned some studies and all that. All the studies with baseline monitoring first have shown no methane and no liquid chemicals going through to the water. Even the ones without baseline monitoring showed only methane, did not show any fracturing chemicals going to the water. Methane by itself in water is not toxic. So that doesn't say we shouldn't worry about it. We should. We have to construct the wells to where they don't, they leak nothing. Okay, but I do not agree with Hope that it is not possible to do it. There's no form of energy without risk. You tell me a form of energy without risk, and then we'll have a discussion. So this question is how much this to take and what the benefit is. And this sucker has given a lot of benefit to the nation. And as I said, it is incumbent on us to have good rules, have the rules followed, because I'm not very sure on how much of the monitoring and so forth, how well that will be done. Depends on which state you're in. But good rules, they should be followed. And then what we need is community action, informed community action to make them better.
Well, Vic, along those lines, I think it's fair to point out that in terms of political input and whether or not it has an impact, you'll remember that there was a moment when the rules about disclosing the chemicals that were used in the fracking fluid were going to be, there would be no disclosure at one point. And I do believe it was public outcry that led to a change in that, and so that the proposed rules now do call for some disclosure. I mean, is that a fair assessment?
No, it's not. There's a lot of innuendo on that, and apparently certain people spoke to other people, but we were not included in that discussion. The commission was not approached. We did not change our course at all. We are accused of taking more time because of something. From time to time, we've taken more time in order to be more deliberate. These are weighty decisions, okay? So, and even to this point, I don't know if the rules are perfect or not, all right? But as I said to you before, this is not, I consider this to be a continuous process. We'll do doing the best we can at this point, and then we'll continue to improve and refine them as we go on.
Hope?
Commissioner Rao is right in that it was the legislature that proposed the very worst form of nondisclosure, not the commission. However, there was a stakeholder group, and I served on that Diener stakeholder, oil and gas stakeholder group, that included industry, as many industry representatives as there were environmental representatives. And that group proposed a public database administered by Diener, not Frac Focus, as the recipient of the data, and proposed a mechanism that is similar to, but not exactly the same as, the release mechanism of trade secret information to emergency responders and medical people. And so public outcry has been a factor, but the very worst form was the legislature's proposal.
I hate to undermine this whole discussion about a very important issue, but I'm going to ask this question. How likely is fracking, are we likely to see fracking in the state of North Carolina, Ted?
I would say very unlikely. The Wall Street Journal ran an article today, and in some areas of the Marcellus Shale, the price of gas is only $1.44 per million British thermal units, and that is not enough to drill more wells.
Give us an idea. What's the break even at the moment, or some idea, some scale, so we know what that is?
Let me begin with the caveat that it's very hard to get good data because this is a very competitive industry and companies don't publish that data. But the Wall Street Journal several years ago published an article indicating that it's probably in the range of about $6 a million British thermal units.
So the price is very low, and you think it's very unlikely that... Vic, Rao, what do you think?
Yeah, it's not that simple. Gas is not gas. So there's something called dry gas and wet gas. A wet gas is gas with a hard component of bigger molecules, propane and butane. Today, almost no dry gas has been produced. That is correct. But wet gas is being produced because the propane and butane sells for almost oil price. So all the money is being made on the propane and butane, and to some degree on the ethane. So it depends on how wet our gas is. And the little evidence we have is not as wet as some of the prospects now being done in Marcellus. Our meaning North Carolina.
Yeah. I know that some of this has been out. The idea that is unlikely that we'll see fracking in North Carolina is out there. Does that in any way undermine your efforts in terms of public health, getting the word out? Hope?
We have encouraged people not to say that too loudly because we feel that as long as there is a risk and that there is the possibility of wildcat drillers, independent high-risk taking, often undercapitalized drillers going out there, that there's the potential for damage to be done even if they never get a marketable amount of gas. So we do feel the public should be not inflamed, so to speak, but well-informed and concerned. And so that's the spirit in which we continue our public educational work.
Kathleen, the opinion leaders that you spoke with in your survey, did they feel that the economic benefits in any way justified pursuing a safe way, a good rulemaking process, because there were these economic benefits?
A subset did. We made a point to interview people who were supportive of shale gas development, opposed to shale gas development, and neutral on the issue. And as you might expect, the people who were supportive tended to emphasize the potential economic benefits and minimize the potential for public health impact. But another interesting difference between the folks we spoke with was that people who were supportive of shale gas development tended to have a greater trust in industry and government. And so they did recognize that there was the potential for spills on site, for water contamination or air contamination, but they had greater confidence that government and industry would effectively manage those risks.
Ted, what's the timescale for creating the infrastructure for making fracking practical in the state?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I can give you a definitive answer. One of the difficulties right now is there's a shortage in certain categories of oil and gas field labor. So that would slow it down. There's the factor of how long it takes to do the exploration. There's really, as Vic Rao said, there's not as much known about the resource here as would be useful to know. You know, if some of the gas is wet gas, that would certainly change it. On the other hand, there are other issues. If the gas contains a lot of sulfur, that can cause, that can be a serious downside. If it contains helium, that increases the value. And for those of you who don't know it, the only commercial source of helium is natural gas.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Ted Fitzhans is an attorney and a professor in agricultural and resource economics at NC State University. Kathleen Gray is the director of the Environmental Resource Program and a lecturer at the Institute for the Environment at UNC Chapel Hill. Hope Taylor, executive director of Clean Water for North Carolina, and Vikram Rao, executive director of Research Triangle Energy Consortium and chair of the Mining and Energy Commission. I want to thank all of you for being on our program. The panel was presented today in conjunction with the nonprofit organization Leadership Triangle at the Full Frame Theater on the American Tobacco campus. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for listening. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachel.